Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good. Welcome back to our, sort of regular but actually quite infrequent Logging Heads encounters, which are more frequent than our encounters in the real world. But I'm Mark Schmidt. I now have the title of Director of Studies at the New America. And why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Catherine Mangu Ward. I am the managing editor of Reason Magazine.
Okay, awesome. We talked a little bit about what we want to talk about, and you wanted to talk about water on Mars. So I want
Yeah.
to ask you about that because I don't know what there is to say other than maybe there's water on Mars.
I guess I want
Or
to
there
talk
is
about
water on
Mars.
Mars.
There is water on Mars. There was water on Mars. There maybe will be water on Mars. These kind of announcements are always very splashy and then maybe not. Oh my God,
Right.
splashy. I'm so sorry. Water on Mars is a splashy
Keep
thing.
going with that. Keep going with that. Every sentence
Okay.
needs to have one.
Okay. I can make it
Drench
happen.
yourself in this topic.
Oh, you're the worst. These NASA announcements are very splashy, but I do think we're having a little bit of a Mars moment. So I guess I wanted to talk about that. We've got the Matt Damon movie, The Martian, coming out. There's a couple of different ventures, including one where people are signing up for a one-way trip to Mars.
Oh,
So I guess
right, yeah.
I think there's probably you could psychoanalyze the American public. Why is it that we're suddenly so eager to get off the surface of this planet? Maybe it's just the upcoming presidential election. I don't know, but I do like that. This is sort of something that has crept back into the national discussion. I think there was a sort of period of despair and disinterest after the space shuttles were decommissioned, and a sort of sense of like, well, I guess we're just stuck here on Earth. And there's been this very interesting resurgence of interest, partially because of these exploratory missions that are unmanned, but also the possibility of getting people back out there. I don't know. What do you think about the new space race? Is there a new space race? Should we
I
be
guess it's
happy
interesting. I
about it?
had, yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm happy to be happy about it. I hadn't been, it's not something I paid much attention to. I mean, I'm sort of conscious that this whole thing that happened when I was a kid of like, everything being about astronauts and, and then it kind of continued a bit with the space shuttle and that, and I guess, Skylab, is there's a great Ann Beattie story where everybody, it's like at every recurring moment, it's like, okay, Skylab's about to hit. Is it going to hit us? Which is a real, just a cultural moment in, I think it's 1979, that, the Skylab falling is almost like a symbol of, and that's before the space shuttle crashes, explosions. It was just like a symbol of that era where there was a stuff that we used to be really good at doing, and now it's kind of a mess and it's falling out of the sky and all that. And there's never been any particular, I think if you're like, particularly nerdy, it's all really interesting, but there's never been, I think, that mass interest in space exploration since the since the that period of the, I guess, late 60s, early 70s. So I guess the interest, like, suddenly the idea of getting to Mars becomes a realistic possibility. Obviously, with unmanned vehicles, it's sort of a realistic possibility, I guess. But I don't. I mean, it's not like driving me. I'm not signing up for the one-way trip or anything like that.
Right. I
happily
do think, I mean,
look at the pictures.
it may also be kind of an effect of the rise of the nerd, right? I mean, at this point, like Matt Damon is playing a botanist in The Martian, right? He's like, it's like the thing he does that's like this super heroic act in the first act of the film is that he plants potatoes in his own feces in order to live on Mars,
Oh,
right? And I think that's,
okay.
there's
You
this
know more
kind
about
of
the movie than I did. I
there's
saw a
a
weird post that I
spo- I
couldn't
guess
even
that's
follow
like
the
a that's
syntax
a
about the
spoiler
potatoes.
alert, the potato thing. I'm giving that away, but I don't think it's going to ruin the drama of the film for anyone. I mean, I think there's the sort of the two choices at the movie theaters in the next couple of years are going to be comic book movies or apparently like Matt Damon being a botanist in space. So
Okay, so
maybe it's just yet another moment where the nerds who were a subculture are now something
right,
that looks
another
like
great
mainstream culture.
like Alan Turing or that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So
that's all I have to say about Mars. I think it's awesome.
Okay.
I thought
you were going to paint a picture of, you know, the libertarian paradise you were going to
there. I,
to
you
launch
know, I
on
think
Mars. Now
the libertarian paradise in Mars is a possibility. There's certainly been, you know, there are many political philosophies that have thought about what their space utopia would look like.
Right.
But maybe there's, you know, thanks to sort of path dependence, Robert Heinlein, there's some sort of big time historical science fiction libertarians who maybe have put us on a little bit more of a capitalist libertarian trajectory when we eventually do have to set something up in space. And actually, the Space Act of 2015, which was sponsored by, authored by Kevin McCarthy, who is now a front runner for John Boehner's replacement.
You do excellent transitions.
I see how I made that happen. So this is a bill about property rights on asteroids, which, you know, given that there's a variety of pressing issues going on in American politics right now, you might not think it's a big deal, but there actually are a couple of companies that are looking to mine asteroids, and this is a question of law that needs to be settled. So there is sort of among the space nerds that I talk to, there is a sense that McCarthy is like a you know, he definitely is a private space, a friend of private space. He definitely is a sort of space buff. He was on the relevant committees. So it might be interesting actually to see what happens if space nerds have a friend in high places coming up.
Right. So mining at like what this would be like, SpaceX sends up a rocket which like grabs an asteroid and then
sort of
pulls
so,
some rare
so,
mineral out of it.
So the companies in question are actually, they would hitch a ride on somebody else's rockets. So SpaceX is not in the business of asteroid
mining. Right,
they're
the transportation.
They're the transportation, exactly. And so these people, at this point, they're essentially satellite companies. You know, they're just sort of prospecting, they're looking around. But yeah, the model is eventually that you would build something that could kind of extract whatever is of value from the asteroids. Now, in general, these companies are, they're kind of, their long-term vision is that they would be the gas stations for outer space, right? So it's not that they're going to mine stuff and bring it back necessarily, although they could if the economics were right. It's more about not having to lift everything you need to go into space off of the surface of the Earth, which is really rather difficult, and instead to just sort of mine it and aggregate it and package it up out there and then use it to keep going. So, you know, it's this sort of like, you know, when we talk about like the rise of the electric car or how we're going to change our transportation infrastructure, and there's always that like very unsexy conversation that's like, yeah, we need to put charging stations somewhere. And
right,
like, who's
right.
going to do that? And how are we going to make the economics
right.
of that work? This is
right.
the equivalent of that for space.
So the series of charging stations between here and Mars that,
right,
that gets
right.
you there. And then what you could, what's the problem? Like you could claim a whole asteroid for yourself, and if some other
right. so,
company came along, you could kick them off?
Right. So the bill passed the House. It has not passed the Senate. So who knows about its fate? But
right.
Yeah, the idea was to, there are already international treaties that govern property rights in space, but they're, you know, somewhat internally contradictory. There's probably a lack of clarity there. So this
right.
was meant to sort of clarify, if you go through all the bother to get out there and get on an asteroid, what happens next? You know, do you own it? Is there a homesteading kind of thing?
Right.
You know, how does it, when do you get to claim it? Is it just when you see it? Is it when you take a chunk out of it?
Right.
So that, the idea of this.
Well, how would U.S. law, I mean, I'm sorry, I mean.
we may be running up the
how
limits
does U.S.
of my
law
knowledge
govern this
here.
Anyway, I mean. I mean,
well,
ultimately,
I mean,
you'd have to get to some kind of international agreement, and
you would.
And what if there are people?
It.
And what about if there are people on Mars and they've got claims too? I mean, not, you know, people who live there already, actual Martians,
right.
you know.
I mean, I
do
think,
they have a say?
I think we're pretty sure there aren't any Martians waiting for us on Mars, at least in the form that would like contest our property rights in a court. But I guess, you know, the joke will be on me if that turns out not to be true.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, the thing is, right, like, eventually you have to solve these kind of disputes at a court somewhere. And so,
right.
you know, at the very least, you know, there are good reasons to think that some of the early companies that are going to do this will be American companies, and that for a variety of reasons, they might be resolved under,
or
at least with some reference to U.S. law.
Okay, all right. I think we have actually the movie that needs to come next is called Space Court.
Yeah. Oh my God, I would totally watch that movie.
You know, The Martian meets Night Court or something like that.
You know, I actually did have a conversation with a friend the other day, and I was asking him, he's kind of a space buff, I was asking him some technical questions about one of these asteroid mining companies, and he said, oh, I don't know anything about the technical side. I'm just a humble country space lawyer. You know, and it's like, it's great that that's a thing that exists. You know, maybe that he doesn't have a lot of work right now, but still there are such people as space lawyers.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. Awesome. Well, I guess, and then they'll use blockchain to figure out the property rights.
You're joking, but that's totally.
I know.
Basically,
all I know is some words to drop. That's about it.
Yeah. But no, that's good. You should also probably just say the phrase 3D printing here, because I feel like that's probably relevant too.
That feels a little bit like, you know, very 2012.
No, man. One of these asteroid companies, there's some kind of microgravity 3D printing foundry thing they're working on. I don't know. It's all very...
So the 3D printing would be done.
Because you got to, you know, once you get the stuff out of the asteroid, you got to...
Right. Oh, you
got to,
like, build the actual little gas pumps or whatever.
I don't know.
You know,
gas pumps,
titanium,
probably. Probably they'll look just like a little SO station up there, you know? Would be good.
All right. Well, that sounds great. So... The lead sponsor of this is Kevin McCarthy, who is, I guess, seems to be the only candidate to be the next Speaker of the House, other than Dan Webster of Florida. But there also is there's a lot of discontent, both with him, I guess, on both sides, right? I mean, there's still discontent from the conservatives, and there's sort of anger about his comments about the Benghazi Committee, which it would bring down Hillary Clinton's that it had succeeded because it was bringing down Hillary Clinton's poll numbers. I kind of won Twitter the other day by suggesting that we change the name of the Benghazi hearings and just call them the McCarthy hearings. I got an unusual number of retweets for that little
more evidence that you and I are inhabiting different corners of Twitter. I think
we are. Yeah.
Although, to be fair, I think my most retweeted tweet of recent times was a joke about manatees, so probably you have the high ground here.
Okay, well, I don't have a huge Twitter profile, but I mean, I've been on it since like the day it started, but I struggled to get past a couple thousand followers. Anyway, do you have any odds on? Do you have any insights into the Republican congressional shenanigans?
Not especially. I mean, I guess I would say that it's an interesting, for those who were on Boehner's shit list, which is to say a lot of the Republicans that I hate a little bit less than I hate everyone else on the Hill, these sort of libertarian small government types you'll recall there was kind of this series of showdowns and Boehner like threw them off of committees and, you know, there was there was a real kind of turf war that happened there. I think those guys probably are hoping to work a new angle, maybe feeling a little bit vindicated about saying, you know, this guy's tactics are not good for the party or the country in the long run. But I suspect that, in the short run at least, okay, so we averted one of a series of basically fake shutdowns Boehner leaving. I don't see a huge amount of evidence that it's going to change that very dysfunctional budgeting process that we have right now. Do you have any hope that this is going to shake things up for the better?
No, probably not. I mean, you still have the same basic dynamic. I mean, we had a fun event here earlier this week where we've been doing a set of kind of case studies of instances where policy coalitions have come together that are not kind of traditional bipartisan deals, but kind of come together from the left and right, often with libertarians and liberals. And, you know, example one is a lot of the new consensus around criminal justice, which is years in the making. And we have a very good paper on that. And then we did an event this week about the new coalition around cutting military spending. And, and Grover Norquist was part of that, part of the discussion. And he's really an incredible verbal artist, and he had a wonderful riff about how these members come in and they're angry at the speaker because they don't have a 2/3 majority in the House and a 2/3 majority in the Senate or a Republican president. And without those things, they can't get done the things they want to get done, whether it's shutting down Planned Parenthood or whatever. That's what they're angry about. And so they throw out a speaker because he can't do these things that, a speaker can't do without either control of the White House or a 2/3 majority in both houses. So it was a very funny take, and basically on the unrealisticness of those members, which of course is really similar to how a lot of liberals were about Obama for most of the beginning of his time in office. The kind of sometimes called like the Green Lantern theory of presidential politics, like you should just be able to get all these things done.
And I actually do think like whenever I hear that kind of frustration, which I totally agree with you, is very common. It makes me always skeptical about when people campaign as Washington outsiders, right?
Right.
And we're, of course, seeing a lot of that on the debate stage in the first couple of Republican debates, although maybe not as much in years past. I don't know. But this sort of idea that there's virtue in being from outside Washington, I'm very susceptible to that. Obviously, I think there is a kind of corrupting influence that happens. Good people run for office for good reasons and then wind up doing things that cannot be understood as good in any sense, extremely often, because
right.
of the kind of incentives that just happen once you're on the Hill or once you have
right.
Office. But the flip side of that is the wildly unrealistic expectations about what you can do in any office, right? And I think the critique of Obama as having limited experience in governance was borne out a little bit in his first term of like he couldn't do anything, and it's not his fault. I mean, no one could have done much given the sort of situation that he was in some ways, but I'm not sure he knew that going in.
Right.
And he had some experience in Washington, of course. Still, I think obviously executive experience is different. I think this idea that people come to Washington with a big plan and no idea of how Washington operates is weirdly accurate, even though, of course, even idiots like us know at least something about that and can talk about it on a blogging head. So, where's the disconnect, right? Like, why is it
right.
that people are still so optimistic?
Right, right. Well, I mean, it's funny. I mean, you can see certain kinds of people. I mean, like, yeah, I hate the basic culture of Washington and the backslapping and the bullshit and the lobbying and all that. I'd support somebody who's, who knows a little bit about that, but doesn't want to, knows enough to not want to be a part of it. It's interesting to see how certain kinds of people who, are outsiders, like, figure out how to be effective. I think of somebody like Paul Wellstone, for example, it takes a while to figure out in a legislative kind, and of course they're different, like being president, you have a certain set of powers, certain other things you really need consensus in Congress. Most Democratic presidents of my lifetime have run into problems with that. Jimmy Carter ran into kind of a buzzsaw, Clinton ran into a ton of messes his first term. In some ways, Obama did better, certainly in what he was able to just kind of move through in 2009 and 2010, measured by just getting stuff done alone. But the president is always hard. Figuring out how to operate in a legislature is hard. The interesting thing to me, I don't really feel like you see any of these guys actually trying, Like, you figure out how do you find somebody else you can work with to get through some idea that isn't been on the table yet, or some crafty, sometimes people talk about policy entrepreneurs, and I was just talking to a political scientist who's written kind of the best book about how people like that operate. You think of somebody like Henry Waxman, just like nudging these little expansions of Medicare forward. I don't feel like there's any of these members of Congress have any appetite for just like figuring that kind of stuff out. And that's kind of
Yeah.
weird to me, you know.
I mean, I do.
It's all just like one big push in one direction. That if you don't win, you actually have nothing.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, you know, not to like mansplain your own event to you, but it sounds like that's what these it sounds like that's what these transpartisanship events that
Exactly.
you guys are doing are kind of, I mean, that those actually are two things, two issues where instead of looking for bipartisan consensus, and like I think it's always true that when you hear something is, you know, a bipartisan bill and that everyone's and you know, that it's really brought Washington together, that always makes me terrified, right? Because that just means it's some kind of like porked up compromise, you know, sort of Franken bill that has managed to bring me. Or it's something like sex trafficking, anti-sex trafficking legislation, which sounds so clearly good that no one's going to want to vote against it, even if it's actually a bad bill. And that's, you know, I think that's, you know, in fact, that is the thing that is happening right now. There's this huge raft of legislation that's moving not just through Congress, but on the state level as well, where we're sort of like, you know, throwing onto the pile of penalties for what are essentially just garden variety solicitation and prostitution in a, you know, a huge number of cases. But now it's human trafficking, it's modern day slavery, we're, you know, everything is terrible. And it's like, who's gonna vote against that, right?
So
So
at the same time, we're beginning to pare back on the tough on crime culture. We're rebuilding it in this other zone,
right.
with
And I
this
do
other
think,
label.
you know, I do think there's this kind of for the children aspect to it, right? I mean, the places where we're rebuilding some of the harshest criminal penalties are still in these areas of vice, right? It's the anti-trafficking stuff. It's also the child pornography stuff, which is increasingly like, you know, high school kid takes picture of his own junk on his own phone and winds up being tried as an adult child pornographer, which happened last week. You know, I think there's, you know, there's this sort of irresistible temptation to mess around with people's behavior and criminalize undesirable behavior regardless. But as you say, stuff like this weird, great transpartisan coalition on criminal justice reform is also making some actual headway. And maybe that's in part because it's largely on the state level. I think the asset forfeiture stuff is still pretty bad, but I do wonder if that, you know, how much of a model is that on the Hill when the budgeting process is not really subject to that kind of dynamic, is it?
No. Well, I think what you see with the coalition on reducing military spending, which really has to do with like actually making the sequester caps stick, is that I think we're going to come out of this with a little bit of a subtle change in budgeting, and I think I think that you know the reduced power of appropriators is a huge thing. I mean, you don't think that those kind of internal shifts within Congress wouldn't seem to matter that much, but they really matter a lot. And there's almost like two different cultures if you're up there. They're like, you know, somebody's the clerk. I mean, they have the most mundane title, they're the clerk for an appropriations subcommittee. They actually have huge amounts of actual power. You know, you have if you want something, you go and beg to them. And anybody else who works up there has, you know, what they have no power. Their only power is, you know, maybe they can, you know, get a vote on something and hope that it goes somewhere. So the shift between those two cultures is huge, and they are vastly less powerful than they used to be. And it's interesting to I mean, I asked Norquist and the other panelists at this event. You know, he was talking a lot about how you needed something like the BRAC, what's called the BRAC process, the base realignment and closing commissions of the, you know, which I guess that process probably started in the 80s. Where you basically have one big vote on the idea of we should close some military bases, but you're not voting on closing your own base, and then the commission comes up with the thing, and then you actually have to vote or for or against the whole package, and you can't just save your own district's base. And I was, you know, I said, you know, we had to come up with this huge contraption to get around this kind of tragedy of the commons. But it's, you know, members of Congress still have bases and they still have military contractors in their district. Why
Right.
are they more able to ignore them than they were in the past. Because you do, you know, the assumption of something like BRAC is no member of Congress can say no to his base or her contractor. So we're going to create a way that they do. Are they better able to say no? And he's like, yeah, they have safer districts. It doesn't matter to them that much. I think he used the contrast of, you know, that Mitch McConnell's last reelection, not the one just a year ago, but the previous one, his campaign had all been about the amount of pork he brought back to Kentucky, and now his reelection this year was really just about ideology, and he was a solid conservative, and so forth. And that's an interesting, that shift in politics could, I mean, a lot of it is stuff I don't like, and a lot of it is stuff that makes it really harder to find any common ground on anything else. But it does break the classic dynamic of budget politics. And, of course, these are guys who, they not only voted to get rid of earmarks, they actually don't want earmarks, and they don't need earmarks. That's a big change.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about the narrow point about earmarks, although you certainly see it still quite prevalently in other places where there isn't this sort of elaborate process apparatus in place.
Right.
I'm thinking here again of the space industry where, you know, the president actually is surprisingly pro commercialization and privatization of a lot of our space efforts. And the thing that is holding back that development is House Republicans with old
from
space
Texas.
Projects in their districts,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And it's weird places. It's not even just like, oh, okay, you know, Cape Canaveral or whatever. It's like, you know, there's a specific place where they're building a specific component of a heavy lift rocket that nobody wants
right.
anymore.
Right. Right.
And it doesn't matter how many times the people who are looking at the issue systematically say, we should probably stop building that thing. You still see this with defense stuff more generally as well.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, you're the fights over which jet we're going to, you know, build or whatever. And I think that, you know, the idea that these sort of safer districts somehow make people more likely to run on ideology, maybe, but I think it also might just be, you know, well, what's working with people this cycle? Like, I could easily imagine all of the cycling back around, and we could be back to pork.
I think it's very hard to keep up high level ideological politics for a long, long period of time, especially because a lot of that, you know, there's a term that's going around now that's like people are actually more motivated by negative partisanship than anything else. So, you know, people can be charged up as much by like hate Obama, as by an actual affirmative agenda. And then when you don't really have, when your ideology is that, you know, it's a little different to, it's hard to get the energy about hate Hillary Clinton, although I'm sure they will get there. But I think it's hard to keep going.
Evidence of like a couple of decades of people being surprisingly energetic about it.
I guess so. I sort of feel like for me, it's hard, you know, for me, it's
thinking.
Like the flip side. Yeah, it's hard to be super enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton, which makes me feel like it's hard to be super. You know, I feel like the Obama hatred is almost like the flip side of the super Obama enthusiasm for a long time. So I feel like because I'm misreading it because I live in a community of people who are just not very .
I mean, I think the counterexample
right.
there is nobody ever was like, oh, my God, like I'm a Bush, you know, I'm a George W. Bush conservative.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Charles Cook at National Review has a whole shtick about that. Right. Like no one says I'm a Bush conservative, but actually the modern day Republican Party, they kind of are.
Right.
And maybe that's at least kind of like a, you know, it's a triple sow cow reverse negative partisanship, right? It's like people hated Bush so much that there was like a not a sort of love of him or a fervent support for him, but you know, at least
people wanted to have his
stubborn defense.
I guess I would say I don't think you know what was sometimes called Bush derangement syndrome. I think that was pretty substantive. I think if there had not been the Iraq War, I don't think you would have had that. I mean, people were charged up about Bush v. Gore, but I also felt that if you look at the whole first year of Bush when they did things like No Child Left Behind, I mean, I think ultimately you felt like he would be a kind of, you know, garden variety, you know, as they say in like sports stats, a replacement level conservative president. You know, not the greatest, not the worst. You would survive. And then he did, you know, just an incredibly, staggeringly mistaken thing, and that's what dishonest and mistaken. And I think that's what drove a lot of people to Bush derangement syndrome. Now you could say the same thing about Obama. You know, a conservative might say the same thing about Obama. We thought he might be an ordinary Democratic president, and then he, you know, basically took over the healthcare system. I mean, that seems crazy to me.
Although he kind of said he was going to do that. Whereas Bush, for obvious reasons, was not able to telegraph what his response to 9/11 would be. So another candidate that I have heard floated, probably just recreationally because the Washington Press Corps is bored and needs something to talk about, but Justin Amash.
This is another candidate for
Michigan,
Speaker of the House.
For Speaker, yeah. I think that's. I mean, he was a sort of key member of this group of Tea Party / libertarian-ish conservatives that got pushed out by Boehner. He's young. He's got a good, you know, personal story. I like him because he's got, like, you know, secret Rothbardian, you know, tendencies or something like that. But he is, I think.
Sorry, back up. What's the word you use? Secret what?
Rothbardian.
Rothbardian.
He's
Murray
got,
Rothbard,
he's got, like,
okay.
some, you know, okay. some Murray Rothbard, some, like,
right,
old
right.
school libertarian intellectual pedigree lurking back
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
You know, I think he, that's another model that sort of dovetails with your transpartisan thing, right? Like, could, you know, if we get somebody that looks like an Amash in there, does that make it more likely to, I mean, he's very ideological,
right?
But he also is doing the kind of like young libertarian conservative reach across, not across the aisle, but kind of like reach around, you know, like through the cloakroom to find common cause with people on the far end of the Democratic Party. You know, do you think that, how much do you think personnel matters, right? Like, is the sort of dynamic of Congress relatively fixed, or if you brought in somebody who's a little bit weird, a little bit different, like an Amash, would that potentially really change the dynamic?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, generally we tend to focus a lot on the personalities of congressional leaders, and I can kind of rank, I mean, I always pay a little more attention to the Senate, but I can kind of rank different kinds of leadership and people who make people feel, you know, feel heard and kind of keep everything going versus somebody like Harry Reid, who really does see it as a, you know, it's a hard charge against an enemy that's out to destroy you every day. And I think that there's times when that's appropriate and times when that's you know, I think there are times when you miss opportunities when you take that kind of approach. And generally, you know, we talk about Tim O'Neill and this and that. It's hard to feel right now like that personality matters much, except for, you know, maybe you get a good, like, you know, a good period when people feel like, oh, thank God that Boehner is gone and this guy listens to us and he's okay. He obviously,
so maybe
he
there's a little air of good feeling.
A little bit of room. And then what do you actually do with that honeymoon? And then, of course, all the same problems present themselves. You can't actually do the things that these members of Congress want you to be able to do.
One thing that Congress is epically bad at, particularly when it comes to budgeting and appropriations, is binding its future incarnations, right?
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I think one concern certainly that I have and that I suspect that actual congressmen have is like, okay, what if they burned all their political capital? What if they set everything else aside? What if they actually put together a sustainable, you know, budget that could be... you know, like actually obtain in the United States government for more than like 90 days at a time. There's no reason on God's earth to think that when the next Planned Parenthood defunding debate, whatever the equivalent of that thing will be in a couple of months, when that comes along, that the whole thing won't immediately get thrown off the rails again. And, you know, I think even, you know, there's... Even like a constitutional amendment, even if you know, sort of the biggest guns that are there, you know, money treats restrictions like censorship, right? It flows around whatever regulations you try to put in place. So you know, I guess on some level, maybe the question is like, why bother? Like, is this the new normal? And is that really so much worse than how things were before?
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right. I mean, I'm beginning to feel like, you know, I feel like the White House wants to look at this and say, let's see if there's one more grab at some kind of grand budget bargain, which,
yeah,
you know, will of course drive liberals bananas.
You know what it actually, you know what it actually is? It's like in the last couple of years in office when presidents will, you know, will always say like, I'm going to take a minute and try to figure out the Israel-Palestine thing.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Like,
exactly the
like,
same thing. Yeah.
It's you're right though. It's that dynamic, except for it's with the budget. It's like, I don't think this is going to work, but like,
right,
if it did, that would be a good legacy. So I'll try. But like,
yeah,
let's be honest about the opposite.
And there is. I mean, it's funny. There is because of the deal in, I guess, 2013. That let the tax rates go up a little bit. There's a little sense, I mean, it's interesting how little Democrats right now are actually interested in significant changes to the tax system. Like, we're kind of, there's kind of a sense that maybe these are the best rates we're going to get, maybe this is the best deal we're going to get. I mean, Hillary Clinton's tax plan consists of some kind of incremental changes to how longer term capital gains are treated, nothing nearly as dramatic as on the Republican side. So you potentially you should have an opportunity for a budget deal where you're not really going to do very much on taxes, and maybe you'll do some other things, and you definitely have a little more room to breathe. But it seems like we've gone from a situation where the Republicans wanted just to hold taxes where they are, to a push for, you know, very, very dramatic new tax cuts. So like I've spent some of the week looking at some of these things. So like the Rubio Lee tax bill, which promises to be, you know, very pro, you know, the idea is it's pro-family because it has a huge, huge child tax credit, although it actually excludes a lot of people who are getting refundable tax credits now. But more importantly, it costs $2.4 trillion, and that's actually nothing compared to all the presidential candidates' tax plans, of which Donald Trump's is in no way the worst. So I feel like we're almost moving away from, I mean, you do have to have an actual budget plan for any kind of long term. You do have to be, you know, willing to be in a basically realistic place about where revenues are going to be.
Yeah, and this is actually something that is, it's kind of a live debate in the Republican Party right now, I think, mm-hmm. which is, Republicans have long been tax cutters, and some of them have been budget balancers. And those aren't the same things at all, obviously, particularly
right.
given the status quo. When you look at the records of some of the people, you know, I think all of them would make some claim to fiscal conservatism. But what that means to different Republicans is so wildly different. And one thing that Rand Paul has done is, you know, when he proposes cuts, he always proposes ways to quote unquote pay for them. And that, you know, of course these numbers always have a little bit of hocus pocus about them, but that is a real difference between the candidates' plans is,
right.
you know, is there even a pretense of figuring out where that money is coming from,
right?
Rather than just the vague sort of hand wavy, like, oh,
it's,
we'll make it more
it'll come from four, it'll come from 4% growth, or it'll come
right,
from 6%
growth,
and
we're
going to
close
the
loop.
You got 6%, I'm going to 8%, you know,
yeah.
the old onion thing about the razor blade.
I think,
you know?
Unlike in past cycles, I actually think there is a little bit more awareness of that sleight of hand going on. There's a little bit more discussion of, you know, well, what does a true conservative do here? What does it, you know, and that's not my favorite framing, but I think, you know, however people want to talk about it, I'm just glad they're talking about it,
which is
something that's more than just, you know, we want to lower the number that is quoted when people say, what are the tax rates? And then like everything else can kind of go to hell. You know, there's a little bit more of a robust debate. And I, you know, still, I think, unless something has changed, the status quo is that everyone on the stage, you know, in the last debate, with the exception of Jeb Bush, when they were asked, you know, when they've been asked this question of like, if you could, you know, cut the government by $10, but you have to raise taxes by $1 or some variant on that question, right? Just sort of a trade-off of like, could a small tax increase be a legitimate thing to do in the pursuit of fiscal soundness, all of them have rejected that. So
right.
I think it's right for Democrats to say, like, this might be, you know, let's hold the line, given the rhetoric out there. But it's also insane as a position for the GOP to hold that, you know, tax increases can't even be on the table.
Right. That's right. Right. For sure. But and also to if you're going to play that game, you do have to be Rand Paul. You do have to be able to willing to say there is a big thing I would cut, and yes, it benefits people, and I'm willing to cut it anyway.
Yeah. I think you're
beginning to see. I mean, the Republican Party has never wanted to do that. I mean, it's always about a balanced budget amendment or like a cap on entitlements that you can't. You know, you can't really pin it down to any one thing.
I think the Republicans have long said they wanted to do that. And many of them, I think, genuinely have wanted to do that.
Right.
It's just that when the kind of rubber meets the road, you know, getting rid of the Department of Education is harder than it looks, right? I mean,
and getting rid of the Department of Education isn't going to have a huge impact on the budget.
Right.
Getting rid of all federal funding for K-12 education would have a little bit of an impact, but you probably don't want to do that, you know.
And this is, you know, in some ways, that debate, which was just a, you know, couple of decades prior version, although admittedly slightly larger numbers, of the defund Planned Parenthood or defund PBS or, you know, privatize the post office, right? Like, the, you know, at some level, all of that was always just symbolic because
right.
the actual impetus to cut government simply is not there or is not there enough in the sort of stomachs of the 20th century GOP to make that happen or the 21st.
Right. All right. Well, you know what? I mean, we're at about 42 minutes.
Let's call it a day.
Very Washington centric. Next time we do this, we got a little bit of, it was like Mars and Washington and not much in between. So, next time we do
what,
this.
What else is there, Mark? That's you've just described you got
the,
my whole
the
world.
The Steinberg so. View of the world. Well, you know.
That's all I've got.
There's Brooklyn.
Basically.
There's Brooklyn, you know.
Fair enough. Next time we'll talk about
Brooklyn. All right, Catherine. Nice to talk to you. Okay, bye-bye.